Majority Rights Radio.
Hello and welcome to another podcast from Majority Rights Radio. This is Guest Worker. My guest today is somebody who we've had several conversations with on the blog and who we know quite well. That's Lee John Barnes, who I'm going to call by the name Lee. Cut out the other bit because it's a footballer by that name. We don't want to confuse you with him. And the meat of this conversation is obviously going to be about events on Thursday, their meaning for nationalism in this country, and for the people of this country. And we'll take it from there and have a nicely casual conversation because there's lots of areas in which we could have quite a tough conversation, and I want to avoid that, I think. First time I came across Lee was on a television program. I'd heard of him, of course. I'd probably visited his blog once or twice, but never really paid a great deal of attention to him. He was just a sort of will-o'-the-wisp figure around the British National Party, and I was absolutely amazed to find this character appeared on national television on a program called The Moral Maze, which has a reputation of involving some very clever people, David Starkey, for instance, Melanie Phillips. These are quite intellectual people who then forensically take apart witnesses who are brought on to testify on one or another subject, and Lee came on as a witness. And the whole thing went very badly wrong, for particularly Melanie Phillips, who had a whitewater eye she wasn't expecting. So well done for that, Lee. It must have been quite a coup for you, and you must
have... It was quite pleasing to actually get onto a programme where they actually try and debate the issues.
Yes.
Obviously, Melanie Phillips tried to hijack it. I would have been more interested in talking to somebody like Keenan Malik, who has got some very interesting ideas and a very interesting critique on multiculturalism. But as I say, it was hijacked by Melanie, and it was a shame because I think that there was a lot of issues that could have been raised which weren't raised, and I felt we let down the listeners, really. You know, people want serious debate on serious issues in this country. They're sick and tired of the pathetic pejoratives and ad hominem attacks that are being thrown at us all the time. People want to hear new ideas, and this is what the establishment are frightened of. They're trying to block new ideas at every opportunity because they're obviously frightened of these ideas being filtered out through the corporate media system and the BBC. Even though I enjoyed it personally, it was nice to have at least a modicum of a debate. It's just a tragedy for the British people that we're not allowed more opportunity to disseminate what we actually stand for rather than the pathetic, facile, asinine propaganda that's constantly chucked about us.
Well, the propaganda's okay. I don't mind people propagandising against the party because eventually it becomes clear to people that they're lying. I know that it's a long process, but it's a process that, at the end of which, the party emerges much stronger and with moral superiority, which would be impossible to obtain any other way. And after Brown's thrown out, you know, people won't look back on this period of New Labour with respect. They'll look back on it as being a period of spin and dishonesty, illegal wars and so on, criminality. So these people pretend to have some kind of magical hold on moral good, which they just don't have. And the bottom line is that eventually the superiority of the victim, which is always an interesting possibility, will come through and we'll have a different kind of dispensation for the future. So it takes time, but in the end it's good. I would much rather that than my enemies be able to actually confront what I'm talking about on points of principle. That would be a much more dangerous situation. The party, in fact, does not face that. You know perfectly well you had this experience with the Moral Maze people. I had this experience regularly on The Guardian. On points of principle, there are no replies to the right of peoples, essentially to the right of peoples to live their lives in peace and freedom. Okay, so let's get back to the election. We've seen something quite interesting that I don't recall before, which is that the electorate has punished all the parties. Nobody has emerged as a winner. I think it'll take quite a long time before this particular election has emerged into daylight, and the pundits are very clear on what it all means. But for nationalism anyway, you've come out and you've said, well, it's something that is connected to the uncertainties of our immediate future, financial, perhaps. And Nick Griffin has come out and said, well, you know, we lost because the turnout was high, and that's a council of despair. What's your opinion on the turnout question, Lee? Do you think that there is a glass ceiling that we can never break through, or do you think that there is a real possibility of emerging one day with a substantial party of MPs?
I think it goes back to the point that you just made about the issue of dissemination of ideas to the public. In our case, we face a hostile corporate media, and we've got those idiots in frocks, which I define the Church of England pseudo-Marxists, the ones who believe that Marx is Jehovah and Che Guevara is Christ. So, the cognitive dissonance issue in relation to the media prohibiting us to get our point across, and also the failure to allow us to have a right of reply and a right to put our platform across at hustings and, no platform at a university, etc., etc. Now, that is the fundamental problem, which is the dissemination of the ideas of what we stand for to the general public, which holds us back. Now, this ties in with my thesis, which I'm working on at the moment, which is that the failure of British nationalism collectively over the last 40 years has been that we put all our eggs into the political basket rather than undertaking a plethora of struggles, a cultural struggle, a social struggle, a civil rights struggle, a legal activism struggle, a community activism struggle. The problem with nationalism is that nationalism as an ideology basically promotes itself as the voice of a community. At the same time, when the only community in our entire country with no consciousness of being part of a community is our community, the indigenous white British community. Yeah. So the primary role of the nationalist movement now as we move into the 21st century is to realise we can't achieve political victory without having a community to vote for us. So therefore, the community activism, the cultural struggle, the civil rights, the legal struggles, all these are the essential foundations for the push into a political victory. It's the political party in nationalism is the point of the spear, but the point of the spear cannot penetrate or reach its target without having the power behind it, which is a community voting for it. And
there's a little of this, though, isn't there, Lee? Because you've seen the party attempt to diversify a little bit with Solidarity and the... I can't remember the name of the organisation now, which has been looking at the civil rights problems that affect nationalists.
There's two of them. There's Solidarity and, I believe it's Liberty. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah, I was fundamental in setting those up. It was a start, but it was not enough. We need people to understand that we need community activism. To me, the most, and this is going to sound extremely, people aren't going to really understand this unless they investigate. To me, one of the most interesting ideas that have come forward in the last few months in relation to this general election campaign have come from the Tories. But it hasn't been deliberately, it's been inadvertent. So their Marxist twaddle about the big society, which it's basically Marxist twaddle, came from a leftist radical called Saul Alinsky. Yes. Now, Saul Alinsky's ideas in relation to community activism are the fundamentals that we need to copy. Nationalism, for the last 40 years, has copied failed political models. Okay, so basically in relation to how to promote itself. Nationalism needs to copy from those who won. And those who won the struggle of politics are the far left. What we need to do is adopt the same methodology as the Marxists did from the 1960s onwards to get to where they were today is where we need to be tomorrow. Basically, we copy from the winners instead of copying from the losers.
We don't have 40 years, though.
Pardon?
We don't have 40 years.
I absolutely agree. This is why we need to accelerate the programme now. We need to put as much effort into community activism as we do into politics. If we don't build a community base, if we don't build a community with a consciousness of itself, we will never achieve the political victory that we need in a first-past-the-post political system to enable us to move forward. And then secondly, on the issue of PR... we have failed to, turn around and go into communities where we know we cannot win a political victory. So simple demographics are is our people are already minorities in those areas. In those areas, our white people are abandoned, atomised, rootless, no representation, no assistance, despised minorities. We need to go in there and organise them into communities. You go into any community in this country, everywhere, any town, any city, you will find African community centres, Chinese community centres, Polish centres.
Yep.
You won't find one community centre anywhere in this entire country for the indigenous white British people.
But you know that it wouldn't survive for the reasons that the BNP has just had to open up. I suspect that there would be some challenge for anything like that. I mean, you couldn't... Who would you exclude and how would you exclude them? How would you stop the place from being taken over by non-English people coming in?
We can't. It's as simple as that. Unless you have your hands on the levers of power, it's a national emergency situation we're facing in this country. We've got 2 million plus illegals. That's an army.
Where did that figure come from, Lee?
That came from Migration Watch about 2 weeks ago.
Oh,
that's
right.
The latest estimate. You know, okay, basically, this country is being colonised by stealth, and the government are doing it. And the generals, you know, what are our generals doing? They're chasing gold braid in Afghanistan and basically surrendering any loyalty to our country. We don't need the troops in Afghanistan. We don't need them in Europe. We need them in Britain.
Let's get back to this idea of producing, I'm going to call it an English working class social base, which by its nature is going to be implicitly racialist, let's say, not in any explicit way. Are you talking about legal activism, this sort of thing? I can see that that can be generated quite easily. But if you've got to construct a community centre, you have to have entertainment, you've got to have a licence, you've got to have quite a lot of things that are difficult to put in place. You're asking people to revert to the kind of life that they enjoyed once in the East End pub or the working man's club. To some extent, some of that still survives. You know, the northern comedy clubs, this sort of thing. Setting up that is quite a big operation, and I don't know that it can be done in any deliberate way. It seems to me that these things tend to grow organically, and you need really to have one start somewhere that is massively successful and is seen as such, and somehow gets under the radar and manages to publicise itself and can be copied. I mean, have you done any really detailed thinking about it, about the costs?
Well, basically, luckily, the Conservative thesis that they put forward during the election is the idea of devolving power down to local communities to enable local people to set up these sort of institutions and bodies, which are exactly what we need. Now, obviously, a community centre as such, for our people, is a long-term goal. The problem with the Cameron idea, which is the big society and his idea of the charitable state, out of the tens of thousands of ethnic charities in this country for every ethnic group that you can think of, there's just one charity in this country for the English, and that isn't defined by ethnicity or race. So therefore, anyone who wants to define themselves as English can avail themselves of the services of that charity. So basically, what we need to do is to push on the legal front to enable us to establish our own ethnic charities, to allow our people access to the government funds which are going to be released down to the local community level, to enable us to have an equal playing field, e.g. to, you know, every other charity at the moment, not only are they allowed to establish and set themselves up for ethnic groups, but any charity under the Race Relations Act has to promote the interests of ethnic groups. So basically, our people come at the end of the queue. So our taxes are subsidising a system of institutionalised racial discrimination against us. Now, as you know yourself, multiculturalism is the most racist and pernicious ideology ever set up. The only people in this country who are denied the right to organise as a community within the multicultural system are our community. That needs to be looked at in relation to a legal issue. Now, what I'd like to see is that for every political activist that we have in a community, we have three community activists working alongside them. In other words, they start to create community networks which allow them to form a cohesive community aware of itself. And then, gradually, as these people become aware that we're living in a multicultural system, if you don't organise and you don't agitate and you don't demand your rights, you're going to get screwed. Okay, and our people are being screwed over every day because they're apathetic and idle in relation to demanding their fundamental rights in the multicultural process. We need to train our people up. We need to do exactly what Saul Alinsky said, which is we discover grievances and then we exploit them for the benefit of our people. Okay, the first step is disseminating the idea that we need this. The secondary step is finding people who are prepared to engage in the project.
Well, there's lots of those in the BNP, and I'll tell you now that the kind of people who are in the party and the kind of people who put up for councils in many cases and don't really cut the mustard there are probably better suited to community activism than they are to politics.
I think you have a potential issue there, which is that we've pushed and pushed to become a major player in the political scene. But at the same time, we have neglected, you know, the community activism side of it. Now, you're right. What we need to do is talent spot. What we need to find is people whose skills... You know, to me, a community activist is somebody who can go down to their local pub, talk to their friends, and then turn 10 Labour supporters into 10 BNP supporters just by talking to him in a pub. That is as important to us as somebody who goes out and puts out leaflets, because, you know, we're creating a community with a consciousness of itself. So I've pushed this in the past, and I've had internal opposition from people whose roles in the party were solely to do with electioneering. And they turned around to me and said, I don't want my people who I'm in charge of being taken away from me when I can use them for political purposes. Well, that's, I understand that. But the point is we've got to get beyond that point now where we're resisting the community activism process.
It does seem to me that anything like this, anything at all in the real world, you have to know that you can actually build it. Not that you want to build it, or not that it would be a good idea if we did it, but that this is an actually real possibility.
You've already given us two examples where we've already done it. Solidarity and civil liberty.
Yes,
okay.
So
basically, hold on. When me and the people who set up Pat Harrington and others set up Solidarity, it started as an idea in my head. Okay. It then became an active form once we started putting the work in. Okay. It works if people are allowed the opportunity to go and do it. Our people are very talented people. The problem is that we haven't done it properly. Okay, and that's what we need to do. First of all, we need to take as much, you know, I had a fantastic couple of comments left on my blog over the last couple of days, which I've learnt from. Okay, now basically what we need to do is we need to have an ideas bank developed within the party to enable people to put forward their ideas. We have to allow people to engage with us on an intellectual level so that people such as yourself, who've got an ideological offering to bring to us, have the opportunity to disseminate those ideas internally within the party. And then we have to act on it. We consolidate the ideas. We need to allocate people who can promote those ideas. We need community activists. That means we need to talent spot and cherry pick people. And another thing that we need to do is we need to go below the radar. In other words, every time that we, none of these groups that I hope to establish, or very few of them, will be political. Because basically, the moment you go political, you hit the radar and the groups attack. We need to go below the radar in relation to culture, community, social, legal, civil rights. Okay, because the moment you go political, everyone attacks you. So basically, that is what the next step has to be.
I certainly agree with that. I think that there's a great deal that can be done. The concentration of the party on the political has probably run as far as it can, and all nationalist parties experience this. If one looks at VB, which I think is the most successful example of this, there is a cultural undercurrent, and VB has managed to, in the Brussels area anyway, has managed to come up with about 32%, I think it is, at its highest, 33% of the vote. Which is getting pretty respectable. I mean, well, certainly Labour anyway have won elections with 35 and 36%. So when you start talking about that kind of percentage, it's okay. So yes, there's an advantage to having a cultural underbelly.
Absolutely.
I accept that point. The point that, as a thinking person, worries me a little bit is that you can just take 40 or 50 years of, well, degradation, and ignore it. I think this is going to be a much more difficult thing to actually produce than you're giving it credit for.
What I'm saying is that our people have innate talents which have been locked away. What we want to do is unlock them. And the primary thing that we need to do is we need to start thinking. Okay, and that means that once we start thinking, we then have to translate that into action. Okay, now I'm not saying to you that it's going to be easy and it's not going to take a while. It will do, but basically the thing is we have to start doing it.
Okay, now let's move on. What do you make of the election result for the BNP? I mean, do you think it presents a kind of end of the road and things have got to be reviewed, or do you regard it as being a minor setback and there are always setbacks along the road and we'll go on and eventually, reach the sunlit uplands? How do you view it?
Well, I'll give you an idea. Okay, the BNP vote in this election was 563,743 votes. That represented a total of 1.9% of the vote. Okay, Jim Fein got 5 MPs, 171,942 votes. In relation to where we stood with UKIP, I believe we beat them in 80% of the seats.
Yes.
Now, our vote rose by 1.2%. Okay, So what we've seen is a party which now over 500,000 people are prepared to vote for. That's our base, okay? And it's everything being thrown at us simultaneously from every direction, corporate media, third-party campaign groups, the BBC, you know, everything to try and bring our vote down and our vote rose. And that's before our society enters the true crisis in relation to the economic fallout, which is going to be occurring over the next year. We've had the credit crisis. We're now entering the debt crisis, okay? And the debt crisis, which has crippled Greece, crippled Spain, crippled Ireland, we're as much the pauper of Europe as these countries are. It's just that we've got more clout in the financial markets to enable us to sustain our, you know, fiat banking system, which is, you know, this parasitic system which runs on credit and then profits the bankers, okay? So basically, you know, even as the thrown at us, we've still managed to rise. Before the storm has hit,
if one takes the view that this, in fact, was a reasonable result, and there's a base that's building up, do you see the base growing to 1 million votes, 2 million votes, 3 million votes? Do you see it going up towards the point where, perhaps not in first past the post, but where you're talking about a major parliamentary body of nationalist MPs? Or do you think that this election result sounded the death knell of that expectation?
No. I think this election result was heralded in an era of new nationalism. It will come by proportional representation. This is why on my blog 2 weeks ago I said to people, if you can't vote BNP, vote Lib Dem. Because of this Hung Parliament is ideal for us. Okay, because basically the Lib Dems are now holding the Tories and Labour hostage on the issue of proportional representation. But basically the Lib Dems, through this PR, are going to unlock for us the potential. You know, PR has already demonstrated with the election of two MEPs. It works for us. Okay, 10 years ago, you said you were a BNP supporter. You were shunned. These days, everywhere you go, everyone says, I support the BNP. They may not vote for us at the moment, but that's because half of the population don't vote, okay? So basically, what we need an Operation White Vote, as well as, you know, this Operation Black Vote. Also, we've got this pathetic communist woman running the Electoral Commission, the Daily Mail have exposed today, okay, who supports Operation Black Vote. We need an Operation White Vote, okay? So basically, what we're seeing is that we've got the foundations for a resurgence and a renaissance in nationalism in this country. If we understand the way the tide and the currents are flowing, okay, and that's what we need to do now. We need to understand that everything that we're doing now is to build a foundation for the future, okay, and that's where we need to go. So, yes, I believe that, you know, the true levels of support for the BNP are never reflected in our vote because very few people go out to vote anyway. And, you know, and as things get worse...
65% this time.
That support's going to increase. So again?
65% was the turnout.
Well, there you go, 35% didn't. And that's not across the board. What you'll see is in some communities you'll have 25 to 35. You know, I have, you know, 65%, and out of those 65%, how many of them are truly British?
Well, you know, I think it works the other way around, in fact. I mean, when I was young, the turnout was regularly. I remember back in the 60s when Wilson and Macmillan were, you know, getting in this sort of thing. Turnouts were regularly 71-72%, that kind of area. And that was considered to be perfectly respectable, and of course it provided the winning party at the time with legitimacy. And it's only been in the last 12 years, really, that we've seen this quite steep drop-off.
Yeah. I think if you look at the series of electoral irregularities in relation to postal voting, the investigations that are opening up across the country at the moment, you'll see that that certain ethnic communities have been exemplary in their
acts. We're talking about Asians. Yeah, that's right. But, I mean, you know, there's a couple of million Africans or so, probably more in this country, and probably 1 million of those on the electoral register. I doubt very much if 65% of those come to the poll. Operation Black Vote exists because they don't.
2 weeks ago, just before the election, there was a huge Operation Black Vote meeting in the Houses of Parliament led by David Lammy. Okay, and in that, they said that the ethnic minority, black ethnic minority groups in the UK hold the balance of power in 50 seats. Yeah. Now, if you add in, the true factors in relation to, you know, it's like Barking and Dagenham, okay? 75% of the population in Barking and Dagenham is white, 25% non-white. What you will find when they do the research in the next year or so to find out why the PMP vote collapsed in that area was because you'll find that because of the amount of time that the leftists and the liberals and Operation Black Vote and the others took into pushing that community to vote, you'll find that their voting levels were vastly above.
Wherever BNP is strong, there'll be an effort to target them. And I think you can say with some justice that Barking was the, you know, was their Schwerpunkt. But across the country, they can't do that. They can't do that in 650 constituencies. They can only do it in one or two or three constituencies, really, to have a national effect. They're not powerful enough to go beyond that.
I don't know about that, David. Basically, what we've got is the most political. We don't have a British national state. We have a servile state. We have a state which is basically which is run for the benefit of political correctness and the minority groups, regardless of whether that's sexual, religious, or ethnic. So basically, every community, every council is run by politically correct Jobsworths who are funded by central government and taxpayers' money to go out and recruit as many people as they possibly can to vote for parties like the Labour Party to keep them in power. So basically, this is why community activism is so important, because as the political system degrades and becomes as corrupt as Zimbabwe, which is where we are now, we cannot keep putting our faith in a political system and a democracy that is no longer a democracy and that no longer functions. So therefore, what we need to do is we need to understand that before we can create a true democracy in this country, the people have to take power back from the parasites and the crooks and the traitors that run us. Okay, and to do that, what we need to do is we need to start organising as a community to enable us to get into positions of power to change the political system back to represent us.
One of the positive ways, Lee, of looking at the outcome of Thursday's election is to see the increase in the vote from Sir Biden. I think it's 13.2% increase, which is quite substantial.
Basically, the issue is that so many of these votes were Eastern Europeans, people were, electoral fraud.
No, I don't accept that. We're talking about large numbers of people. The point I was trying to make, anyway, if we just set aside the possibility that the increase in votes is only foreigners, and accept the fact that some of that increase may well have been around people.
It's not just foreigners, David. What you're going to see is you're going to see that the servile state has took. There are sections of this country who employ more people on the state than than the equivalent in China. Okay, so basically, what you've seen is you've
25%,
seen people, absolutely. What you're seeing is that the state itself, these people who've been taken on by these Labour councils and politically correct organisations, they're not idiots, they're not going to cut their throats and vote for a party which is going to, sack them. Okay, so what you're seeing is that it's like in Greece. Okay, the reason why the Greek people on the ground are revolting is because the Greek social security system is so cushy for them that any of this austerity package is going to destroy their luxury lifestyles. This is what we're seeing in the UK in relation to voting. Those on the public services are not going to be voting for parties which are going to turn around and say, well, we're going to sack all you lot because you're superfluous to needs. There's two ways of dealing with the public services. We can renationalise them. In other words, we turn around and say, look, only British citizens are entitled to access the NHS. Only British citizens are entitled to have education. Only British citizens are entitled to welfare benefits. Everybody else, if you're an illegal or an immigrant who's not paid into the system, etc., you're not entitled and you're not getting anything. That's renationalising. This was the BNP, and it was a real shame that we didn't highlight this issue on our propaganda level all through the election. The Tories, Labour said we're going to offer tax cuts and public spending cuts. The Tories said we're going to offer tax cuts and public spending cuts. We could have turned around and said we're going to offer tax cuts and a public spending rise because we're going to renationalise our country. In other words, if you're here illegally or if you're here and you haven't paid in, you're not getting a penny. We could have improved every public service without putting a penny in by getting rid of the extraneous demands from these people who should not have been entitled to those services. It was a shame we didn't hit that issue because I think that would have done pretty well.
Well, okay, let's move away a little bit from, I don't know quite what we've been talking about, to be honest. You hit the ground so hard and you run so fastly, you're a bit of a shock to my system. My brain doesn't operate at that speed. But let's move on to the kind of problems that the party faces in trying to get its message across. I think that it's accepted generally that we are not going to be able to break into the media. We're not going to be heard. We're always going to be vilified. If you look at the threads on newspaper articles, whether they're allowed, they're full of people saying, oh, more vilification of the BNP, when is this going to stop? That's commonplace now. When ideas enter into the public life, they tend to increase and move on and gather more adherents. And there's no question that this idea that the media is corrupt is out there now. In fact, on Simon Darby's blog, he put up a number of videos after Nick's appearance at the Christian radio station, which was quite interesting, about 6 weeks ago. Did you see those? You must have done.
And, No.
Well, you know Nick appeared and did very well and was interviewed with George Hargreaves, the black pastor who stood against him in Barking. And they had a very productive conversation, and lots of people were very, very pleased about the respectful nature in which this conversation was conducted, and that the Nazi monster that I don't suppose they really expected to see for the reasons I've just explained. They know that the media lies, but the Nazi monster turned out to be a thoughtful and respectful person and did himself a power of good. Now, after the show, they did a phone-in to a Christian radio station, and there was this black guy at his PC with the camera on him, talking to people who are phoning in on Skype or whatever, however it's being done, I don't know. And one particular lady rang. She was obviously a black lady from South London, religious, and she said that last year they'd had a BNP member come into their church group and talk to them, which was very adventurous. And she said that he was very respectful and a God-fearing man. But somehow or other, UAF managed to put a demonstration outside, even for this. And the interesting thing is, she said that they showed that the evil people are the ones who are out there protesting. And that the good person. So, you know, you can't stop this idea once it comes out that actually there is an evil at work, and it's not the BNP, it's quite the reverse. So I'm happy about that, and I don't mind that all this vilification goes on. It can only in the end lead in one direction.
I agree with you 100%. The problem is the whole system is called cognitive dissonance. Okay, and basically, what has to happen is that for cognitive dissonance to occur, the media have to go overboard and scream, you know, they're monsters, and then we get to know them on the doorstep, and people see that we're human. Basically, in order to combat media conditioning, the only way that you can do it is through direct contact with people at the community level. This is why I've argued that an election doesn't begin a month before the date that people put across on the ballot paper. It begins 2 years before. And that's why our activists have to get out into their communities 2 years before, knocking on doors, building up contact with local people, so that when the media promote this idea of that we wear horns and have towels and, you know, etc., etc., that they know that it's utter rubbish. It causes cognitive dissonance. But the media at the moment are attacking us, they're preventing us getting on the hustings, and they've got no platform at the universities. So therefore, the people who are media conditioned by the media to believe media propaganda still believe it.
About 20% of people will believe that.
Say again.
I can't point to the research now, but the figure for people who simply believe what they're told, who simply follow authority in any society, is about 20%.
So, well, I think one of my favourite writers is Alain Benoist, and in his thesis for the New Right, the French New Right, he said that as a result of the breakdown of the traditional nation state in relation to globalism and the empowering of the corporate media, what's happened is we no longer have societies. What we have are rootless individuals who are part of smash communities who no longer have any idea of the nature of their society that they live in, because the only idea of the social consensus and that they're gaining is via the media. In other words, people are so too frightened to go out, and he goes, Robert Putnam, in his book Bowling Alone, where he offered that fantastic critique of the myth of diversity as our strength, he made exactly the same, which is exactly that where multiculturalism creates a perceptual shutdown in people, forces them to stay indoors, destroys community integration and community social cohesion, and so therefore, in order to combat this, the only way you can do it is on the doorstep, okay? And this is why, if we're going to defeat the media conditioning, community activism is an essential. Okay, it rehumanizes us.
Let's go back to my point, and this is something which came up on the blog last night, and which I said at the time, I think perhaps I'll ask Lee about this.
Yep.
Now, the harder-edged side of nationalist discourse concerns areas that we can't talk about at all. the moment. And the party, of course, has sort of completely cast them off. And principally, this is the Jewish question, the power of Jews and the effect of Jews, the question of the Holocaust, the kind of thing that is extremely evident in white nationalism in America. Now, that's been completely excluded.
That's because it's an irrelevance. It's historical.
Let me finish.
It's absolutely irrelevant to where we need to go.
Let me finish. Now, a nationalist, as opposed to simply nativist movement, a community of ideas will take positions which are currently not available to us to talk about.
Why?
Well, because they're in the totality of the situation. I mean, if you were talking about liberalism, you can't really address liberalism without understanding the effects of Jewish intellectualism on it. You can't really understand education, even, without...
Come back to what I've said earlier to you, which is that nationalism has wasted 40 years attacking those who are more successful as a community in our country. Listen, the reason why these ethnic groups, and it's not just Jewish groups, it's every ethnic group, have their legal groups, ethnic lobby groups, etc., etc. The reason why they have managed to do so is, one, because they organise at communities, and two, because we failed to organise as a community. Okay,
Come away from that for a minute. Well, this isn't what I want to talk about. What I'm trying to get to is how much truth can a party actually speak when it is operating...
I'm a nationalist, okay? I'm not a national socialist, okay? Now, national socialists... More nationalists were killed during the Second World War by national socialists than Jews were. Okay, so basically, anyone who turns around and confuses nationalism with national socialism is an idiot. Now, if somebody wants to, try and create a model based on Caesar and the Roman Republic, or Attila the Hun and the confederation of Hunnish tribes, okay, if that's what they're into, you know, whether they want to create the Soviet Union, whether they want to recreate China and Pol Pot and Mao, etc., if they want to get into that historical fetishism, and that's their thing, and it gets their groove on, fine, let them go and do it. Bugger all to do with British nationalism.
Right. How do you deal then with the kind of activity at your level, let's say in education, in schools, how do you deal with opposing that unless you know where it has actually begun, where it comes from, what its antecedents are?
We can't oppose it. Come on, you know, accept where you are. Look, the first duty of any, you know, general is to understand what the forces are at his command before he marshals them and marches them into battle, okay? We have to understand we cannot turn around and dictate to schools what their agenda will be because we don't control the government.
No,
okay?
But you're in your white community centre, okay? You're in your community centre, you're at the bar, you've got a few people around you, and you're talking about the fact...
No, look, this is what you're misunderstanding. You seem to think that I want to run them on the lines of a Maoist indoctrination centre. I just want somewhere for kids to go at night to be able to play football, to be able to get out of away from the drug dealers on the street corners, to be able to get away from corrupt police officers who go and, you know, and use them to politically brand those their way up the greasy career pole by picking on.
You told me a while ago that you had huge respect for guys who can go into a pub and over 3 weeks turn 10 people into nationalists.
Okay. David, listen, okay, what we need is our people to start understanding basically that they are a people, and in order to do that, they have to come into contact with each other again. Okay, so they have to care. Okay, I put a link up on my blog today to an interesting speech by an ex-CIA officer who turned around and said that the Industrial Revolution, one of the side effects of it was it smashed communities, kin networks. Right. Okay, this is what happened when they
destroyed. I agree with that. I said many times that there is a very, very long process involved here. It's not something that starts in 1945.
Absolutely, you start with first footsteps.
Right, but look, I just want to get back to this. I mean, the fact of the matter is, when you look at what's happened to kids in school and in working class white areas, they have no, you know this, you're talking about this, they have no contact with their own history, with their own culture, and with their own peoplehood and so forth. They don't have that. And I want to go back to a statement which I heard Philip Beadle make. This is a very intelligent guy. He's a teacher who wanders around the country lecturing to teachers about problems in the system. He put up a very interesting series of three, in fact, of YouTube films, about 30 minutes apiece or so, on the problem of the white working class. And in the course of it, he was speaking to a group of teachers, I think at the NUT, He said that he'd been in assemblies where Rosa Parks and Nelson Mandela and Jesse Owens were praised to the skies. The only white person who was mentioned all term was Adolf Hitler. And yeah. The effect on the white kids was that, you know, they were cringing with embarrassment at this and just had no way to relate at all to the educational process that, you know, there was nothing for them to look up to. There was only this terrible example of fallen humanity. So, you know, when you look at that and you say, well, okay, that's what's actually going on.
I totally agree. It's our responsibility as a political party to allow our people the information to enable them to rediscover their culture and to re-educate them about who they are and their history and their background. That's our job.
But you know that means opposing the Holocaust Education Trust, for example.
Why? Why would you? You know, if the Holocaust was a historical, fact. The point is why do I want to? You know, I might as well be arguing about how many people died in the Teutoburger Forest when Arminius attacked the Romans. No. It's any relevance to where we need to go?
It's highly relevant because it's a political movement.
David, look, okay, what I want to see from Holocaust Day is the end of it being politicised, okay? I want to see nationalists stop politicising it. I want the Holocaust Day to mention the Arminians. I want it to mention people like my uncle who died 6 months after coming out of a Japanese prisoner of war camp after being captured at the fall of Singapore. I want it to mention the British soldiers who were held in Japanese prisoner of war camps. I want it to mention, you know, the Africans in Rwanda. I want it depoliticised. I want a Holocaust Day to remember Holocausts. Okay, so basically, that you know, the opportunity to exploit it for political purposes by all communities has to end. Okay, that has to end.
Well, with respect, I don't want a Holocaust Day. Of course you don't. A Holocaust Day is not there so that you know, black kids can feel bad about Rwanda. A Holocaust Day is only there in order to prevent.
David, you're absolutely right. It's being cynically exploited by left-wing morons for their own political purposes. And that's why it has to end. But the issue for me as a British nationalist is this. I know that within 50 years, this country will go down the route of Serbia, Bosnia, Kosovo, etc., etc. And you will see a civil war in this country. Okay? Everyone knows it. Nobody wants to talk about it. I want to defuse that via the demographic political process. Okay,
to
make sure that our people remain a demographic majority and that we create a stable society to enable us to do that. Okay, the issue is that the multiculturalists will create the next Holocaust. Just as Churchill turned around and said, the next fascism will be anti-fascism. Okay, now that is the issue, and that is the sick, perverted irony of multiculturalism. It will create the next Holocaust. And it won't be white people creating the next Holocaust in this new multicultural liberal fascist state that's on the horizon. It will be ethnic groups going to war against ethnic groups, just as they did last year in Birmingham, where you had you had black groups killing Asian groups. Okay, what you will see is that if this will happen, as Trevor Phillips called the white community in this country, the cotton wool that stops the friction between the other communities. And that's exactly what's going to happen. The multiculturalism will create the next Holocaust. That's why I want the Holocaust Day to be depoliticised, so that people understand that if we carry on with this multicultural model, just as Rome fell, which was multicultural, just as Egypt fell, the ancient Egyptian Empire, which was multicultural, just as the British Empire fell, which was multicultural, just as the Soviet Union fell, which was multicultural, multiculturalism will fall and will usher in another Holocaust.
I'm afraid the Holocaust Day doesn't warn us of that. You know that. The point I'm trying to make is that it is a tool that is used against one specific section of society.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's perverted.
Right.
That should be stopped. Anyone, the cynical exploitation of the Holocaust for financial gain, e.g., you've got the Norman Finkelstein in his book, The Holocaust Industry, and then the cynical abuse and exploitation of the dead in the Holocaust by leftists for their political ends is sick. Anyone who can do that is sick.
You know they're not leftists, don't you? You know that the Holocaust Day, like the hate speech laws, like so much else that we have forced down our throats, doesn't originate with leftists.
If you see a difference between a communist and a liberal, I don't know where it is. You know yourself, liberalism is the trailblazer for communism. Okay, liberalism is the pimp, little pimp sister of the communists itself. So basically, you know, we're heading into a communist society. We're virtually in a communist society now. Just that at the moment, the capitalists are funding it by their taxes.
No. We're not going into a communist society. What we're going into is a global society. Communism is not required for a global society. In fact, the globalist idea doesn't require centralised government or anything like that. All it requires is the power of corporations.
I think you'll agree that the model of the New World Order, which we're heading into, is one where these centralising and supranational institutions are a fundamental basis. What do you think is the climate change and the carbon taxes? The carbon tax is the creation of a global economic system to enable them to escape the national currency system. You know, the only reason why the euro is collapsing at the moment is because the European Union doesn't have a central taxation policy.
See, you can talk to me about lots and lots of, and you're very happy to do it, you do it very, very well, you bang away in great style, about lots and lots of negative factors. I mean, we can cover capitalism, we can do communism, we can globalism, we can do the left, but there are some things that we cannot do, and you cover that by saying they're irrelevant, so I don't have to go there, and I'm saying we don't want to go there.
Well, like what?
The truth
give
is,
me an example.
Well, you know
give
perfectly well that hate speech law, for instance.
Well, I've already said if you read everything that I've ever written,
that's leftist law. You do know that, don't you?
Actually, if you wanted to look at it, you'll find that the hate speech laws in this country were drafted up by people with links to the leftists and liberals. You know, the first model of multiculturalism itself in Canada was based on the idea of liberal and leftist values. You know, the fact is that, you know, my policy on hate speech is clear. You know, I believe in free speech. In other words, you know, every single one of these ridiculous hate speech laws needs to be struck down, along with this, the Equality Commission itself. We don't need them. They're utterly irrelevant. You know, the issue is that, you know, if we can talk about how many angels dance on the pin, you know, on the head of a pin.
I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about how free you are to speak. You're talking about, you know, you want free speech, and I'm telling you that you're not free to speak.
And
in fact, you're telling me in reflect you don't want to be free to speak.
It's
inconvenient to be free to speak. That's what you're telling me.
No, I'm not. I'm saying to you that if you scrap the free speech laws, there's one provision on the law which we need to have in place in relation to free speech, which is an incitement to murder. Anyone who sets out and says, "I want you to go and kill Mr. X," yeah, deserves to go into prison for that. Okay? And just as Lethal Bizzle, the rap artist last week, sent a tweet out saying that, want to be a hero? Go and kill Nick Griffin. So we made a formal police complaint against it. That's where the boundaries of free speech end, when you incite murder. Okay, that's the only point where free speech should end. Okay, apart from that, I believe anyway, you know, people want to talk about, you know, Caesar, Hitler, Stalin, Lenin, whatever. You know, that's free speech if they want to do it. I'm against the Holocaust denial laws. Not because I deny the Holocaust, but because I support free speech. You know, Holocaust denial laws are an atrocity in a democracy. They undermine democracy itself. Not because I believe that those people who deny the Holocaust have any intellectual depth in relation to their arguments, but because it's a demeaning of the rights which our ancestors fought for to enable us to live in a society that values free speech.
Okay, Lee, let's finish with one question, because we've talked for longer than expected, and I'll probably have to chop this into two halves to get it to upload as it is. Returning to the political future of the BNP, you seem to believe that it is still capable of growing and building a base, and you're looking to PR to assist with that. We may not get PR. I don't know what's happening on that front at the moment, but the Tories are obviously under a lot of pressure from within the party to resist it. And they may well be able to buy off Clegg without going that far, but we shall see. So, with or without PR, you still think that the BNP has a future. Let's talk about that future. Do you think that the present, this is a difficult one for you, and you may not want to answer to accept that, do you think that the present leadership, as it is currently composed, which is quite a narrow leadership, it's quite a centralised leadership, do you think that leadership is capable of continuing this journey over the next several years?
Basically, I think this is one of the fundamental flaws of nationalism over the last 40 years, the cult of personality. Okay, I don't want nationalists to play follow my leader. I want every nationalist to become their own leader. Community activists empower themselves and then create communities. This obsession with having been led by a personality is not just, you know, personally pathetic on an individual level. In other words, get a life, okay? Get out there and create your own world that you want to live in. Become a one-man revolution. Become your own leader, okay? Let's get nationalism away from the cult of personality around. Look at this debate they had on TV the other day with Clegg Brown and Cameron, okay? Pathetic. All it did was reduce policies to personalities. I want to get back to, rather than playing follow my leader, everyone becomes a one-man revolution themselves. Go out there, create the change that you want to see. Well, that's a bit Obama-like, but, he got it from Saul Alinsky, and that guy knew what he was talking about.
The fact is that we've got a leadership that seems to be interested in, let's say, in the cult of personality. And it's increasingly obvious that there's nowhere that change can actually enter the process, because Nick's got all the power that he could possibly have in his own hands. There's a large community of nationalists, disaffected, who inhabit the two main fora that discuss these issues, who would very much like to see some change in that. At different times, different members of that have attempted to introduce change, and they've wound up outside the party. So this is a dangerous situation. The question
what
is, should it continue?
Okay, what do these people do? They spend all their time talking bollocks on the internet.
No, don't attack them.
What they need to do, David,
they're honest people. They're like you. They're honest people who talk their own mind. They thought that at some point in the past they were going to be able to change the leadership of their own party, as people do. This is something that happens.
David, this is the issue, okay? The issue is, why, yet again, has everybody put in everything into one, all their eggs into one political basket? Look, there are people who should never have joined the BNP. There are people who should never have joined the BNP in the first place, okay? Those people, if they've got talents and skills, utilise them by going out there and forming their own networks and going out there and getting on with their own thing. Stop turning round and expecting the BNP what you want to be what you want it to be. We're not interested in changing for your benefit. If you've got something positive to...
What I'm talking about is whether the party can actually move forward, can actually progress.
Why are you talking about the party again? The point is, look, if nationalists want to see change, nationalists need to go out and create change. That doesn't mean you can always do it. I've said to you that the political party in the nationalist movement is the point of the spear. Okay. Now, the fact is that nobody, as in any political party or any movement, agrees 100% with everybody. The point is to stop whining about the BNP. Get out there and create the change that you want to see. If you're not prepared to do that, then to be honest, shut the fuck up, because I'm sick and tired of listening to their whining whilst we're trying to fight to save our country and culture.
Yeah, the difficulties which people have with shutting up arise not because they are awkward people, I think, but because there's a unfortunate tendency for the party to score own goals. We've just had Bigotgate, for heaven's sake. Can't we at least acknowledge that it's a good idea if you don't pick somebody for a constituency and then have them reported to the police for trying to kill you or something? And for Pete's sake, this is not the way that we want our political vehicle to behave. Natural for people to complain about
Look, what you're doing is you're saying the BNP doesn't suit me.
I'm saying that the BNP should conduct itself in a way.
Okay, listen, for you, there are another 100 people who will turn around and say, you're talking out your arse. That's the fundamental nature of nationalism. Nobody agrees. You could put 3 nationalists together in a room, and within an hour, you'd have 2 new parties and somebody working for Searchlight. Okay? We're never going to agree. The point is not to agree. The point is diversity of opinion within nationalism.
So
if we act on it, we can create change.
So is it unacceptable then to disagree that there should be something of a train wreck going on all of the time.
You know yourself, there's positive contributions and negative contributions. Those who spend all their time pissing and moaning on the internet and typing off massive emails, missives attacking everybody and rumour mongering, etc., etc., they are the inner enemy of nationalism. I don't care what you say about me. I am constantly critiqued.
I like you. I don't have any problem with you. I do think that there is an issue. You'll have to forgive me because I'm a middle-class sort of Tory-like person, really, instinctual conservative. Don't mean that in a party way sense particularly, but nonetheless, for most of my life, I voted for the Conservative Party. And when I look at the vehicle which currently expresses my political views better than any other, I am a little bit put off by the fact, to put it mildly, that there's a continual train of events occurring which are bad news. Things are done incredibly badly. And I said at the beginning of this, I'm a businessman. And
David, you have a lot to contribute. People like yourself have a lot to contribute. The issue is that contribution can be positive or it can be negative. Okay, what I'm saying to you is that if you have something positive to contribute, we in the BNP need to open ourselves up.
If I was involved in the party, I would be thrown out in 5 seconds flat because what I would want to do would be to kick Nick out of management of the party and let him lead the political effort. But the management of the party is something he should not touch because he is toxic. And that's my view.
And you're absolutely entitled to that view. And what I'd say to you is you're an intelligent, erudite person, okay? You have a lot to offer the movement. Are you active in any way? Are you a member of a political
party? No. I wouldn't survive in the party.
I'm not asking you to join a BNP. Are you active anywhere other than on the internet?
No, of course not.
Well then, there you go. So what I'm saying to you is you're like a loaded round that is sitting there in a rifle that won't fire itself. This is why I have 1,000 times more respect for a candidate who gets 5 votes in an election than an intellectual who sits on the internet and does bugger all. Okay, because they're out trying to create change in their community.
Let's get it straight. I live in a beautiful part of the country. I've got forest around me. This is one of those places where, you know, the Conservatives have been in power for the last 200 years, and they will be for the next 200 years. And there's absolutely no prospect. I don't live in the inner city. I was brought up not very far, probably, from where you were brought up. I mean, I was brought up in South London. But I don't live there now. And so, I mean, you know, I'm not about to go and live there either. So, I mean, I'm not expecting to stand for Parliament anytime soon. What I'm trying to say is that to use people, any kind of people like me, not me particularly, but people like me who have experience of the way things are done and how organisations are run, if you're going to bring in people like me, professional managerial people, then you have to be open to the talents which we bring. And I've got to tell you right now, I don't believe the party is open to it. I think the party is completely closed to any kind of professional management.
But you know yourself,
it's becoming narrower by the day.
You know yourself, okay? Change doesn't occur unless people actively involve themselves in forcing change. Okay, now, you can be a conscientious objector all your life, but conscientious objectors have never won a single battle in history, okay? Now, the point is that if you want change, create change. If that means you want to see the BNP change, go and join it. Now, I don't know about you, you know, the issue is that I believe that, you know, and I've put, you know, everyone who knows me, and Nick, I've said this to Nick, and I've said it to other officials, we need to open up the party to new ideas. And that's what I've been pushing for a long time. And unfortunately, some officials in the past have block that because of their own little power building and their own little power base. I believe that was wrong and it's damaged us as a nationalist party and as a nationalist movement. Now, what we need to do is people like yourself who have an intellectual contribution need to offer that to us. Then, if you have to understand, David, that we can't run a party on the grounds of catering to your ideas as much as any individual's ideas.
I'm not asking for that. What I'm saying is that the kind of people who the party needs are not going to join the party because of the way it's currently structured and run. If you look at ordinary political parties, they're absolutely full of people like that. And I'll tell you who they are. They are the educated middle class.
They're the cowardly class who are prepared to keep quiet whilst their country, their people and their culture are destroyed.
They are not. Listen, I'll tell you now, if you think you'll get on board educated people who've got a lot to lose, like this architect fellow who very bravely stood, and he's been punished by his professional body as a result. You know, if you think those people will come in and you need them, while this train wreck goes on, and while power is centralised as it is, you're mistaken. But by God, you need them.
David, listen, okay, if we had Bob Marley running the party and our party anthem was One Love, okay, we'd still be called Nazis, not because of who we were, but because we what we stand for. Because we represent a threat to the establishment and established interests. Okay, David. Okay, look, if somebody is worried about losing their job, it's like the police. Police can't join. Prison officers can't join. Yes. Okay, well, you know, if you're a policeman or a prison officer and you support nationalism and British nationalism, get active in another way. Okay, so what I'm saying to you is the BNP is not the organisation or the a vehicle. It's not the Holy Grail. Okay, so don't put your faith in it as though it's the Holy Grail. What you need to understand is that go out and become and you know your own. Use a trite analogy. Become your own Grail Knight. Okay, create the change. Go out and do it. Don't, you know, you're right, David. The BNP needs to open up to new ideas and it needs to change in relation and learn from its mistakes in the past, just as every political party undergoes evolution. The Labour Party of 15 years ago that dumped Clause 4, okay, is not the Labour Party that we've got today.
So
okay?
Let's go back to the original question then. As the party is currently constituted and run, can it fulfil its historical obligation to the British people? Can it do that as it is now?
David, you're misunderstanding the nature of what we need for the future, okay? As I've explained to you, the BNP is the tip of the spear, okay? The BNP can't do anything unless our community, the fundamental historical duty that our generation has to the future and to the past and to the present, is to create a consciousness of itself. In other words, we have to create a community out of the chaos that we live amongst at the moment. If we fail to do that, no political party, even if it was led by Bob Marley, will ever attain power, okay? Because we do not have a consciousness of ourselves, and therefore we don't have a cohesive voting base to propel us into power. That is the fundamental struggle which we need to embark upon now.
I'm not in disagreement with that. I think that's perfectly obvious. But it still didn't answer the question. You're dancing around questions here rather than just confronting them straight on. And I mean, I know you have a legal background and this is what lawyers do, but, you know, it's frustrating.
We disagree on the fundamental nature of what role a leader has in a party, what role a party has in the struggle, and what the role of a nationalist movement is. We fundamentally disagree. Okay, what I'm saying to you is whatever political party you have, if its principles are the same as the BNP, it will be attacked. Whatever political party there is in any country, anywhere in the world, you'll have people who agree with what he's doing and people who don't. What I'm saying to you is those who don't agree with the way the party is run, is go out there, instead of whining, bitch, pissing and moaning, get out there and create the change that you want to see in your community. Instead of attacking the BNP, forget about us, move on and create change for yourself. That way we all win.
Okay, Lee, thank you very much indeed. It's been a interesting conversation. I'm very glad I've had it, and I'm now going to go away and shorten it a little bit, I think, because it's too long. And I hope you'll download it and listen to it and let me know what you think of the final result.
Yep.
And all the best to you. Thank you very much indeed.
Take care, mate. See you soon.
Cheers. Bye-bye.